Audio Discourse of the Plan for Restoration of Constitutional Government by Gary Hunt, Outpost of Freedom. Episode 1, Preface. The Plan for Restoration of Constitutional Government, as explained in The Question, is purely hypothetical. It's a natural evolution from a petition, the You Have Tread on Me petition, as the Revolutionary War was a natural evolution from the Olive Branch petition. In taking those events of the founding era and looking at them in perspective to the modern world, we can put together a picture of what might suit us. We know that we can't take a gathering of revolutionary delegates and put them in one place, as the government would swoop down on that place and find charges against virtually everybody with any intelligent input into the process. Understanding the difficulties that exist today, if the people were to execute the petition and send it to their representative and two senators as a redress of grievances, as per Article 1 of the Bill of Rights, they would be, in effect, sending an olive branch petition individually, not collectively, to their designated representatives. Absent a positive response to that petition, one could safely conclude that the government had no intention of addressing the grievances any more than King George III did back then. Thus, by colonial standards, each of us would be putting ourselves in a state of nature absent an operating constitutional government, wherein, as a free man, he has every right to associate with others of similar circumstance. An earlier article that I wrote explaining the process of dissolution of government is Sons of Liberty number 14. It explains the relationship of the people to the government and the obligation of government and the consequence of dissolution when it's based upon that government failing to abide by the Constitution. As you go through the hypothetical plan, you will note that there are short sketches or historical perspectives that provide a brief example of the historical condition that can be equated with each part of the plan. The plan is 10 parts, and each one will provide an historical perspective from then and explain how that can be accomplished now. The plan is made as a detailed expedient for a variety of possible circumstances. Understand that no plan is perfect and has to be adapted to the exigencies and conditions locally. With that in mind, it's a general guideline, a sequence of events, you might say, but it might give some ideas that could be modified to be more suitable and more effective in achieving the objective of restoration of constitutional government, both on the state and the federal level. Often within the plan for restoration of constitutional government, there are elements that have been addressed in greater detail in articles that are not included within the plan, however, they are linked within the plan to give a better understanding of certain aspects that are being addressed by the plan. For example, when we look at the judicial branch of government and restoring it to a constitutional realm, we need to understand how the judiciary used to work, how the grand juries used to work, how the petite juries used to work. Without that understanding, and our only model being what we have today, which is ruled absolutely by either, in the case of grand juries, by the U.S. attorney, the state attorney, or the county attorney, and in the petite juries, where the instructions from the judge are more of a checklist to confirm the guilt or innocence as chosen by the state, rather than an evaluation of the facts of the case and a determination by the jury whether they think that the person is did commit the acts, is guilty of a crime, or whether what he's accused of should not be a crime at all. The plan is provided for your pleasure and education. What you do with it is up to you, and what you do not do with it is a point of consideration for your posterity. Now, a while back, somebody asked me to explain the plan in a couple of sentences. Well, I couldn't provide such a short description due to the complexity of the plan itself. However, in numerous conversations with people, I realized that there was perhaps an analogy that would bring this home. Suppose you had a map of the United States and it was all black. Black represented areas under the control of the repressive government, where despotism existed. And this includes state as well as federal. Now suppose that a small dot appears on the map. A few days later, another white dot appears, and they're scattered throughout the country. Then these dots begin to grow, and then they begin to merge with other dots. And as they grow, they start accumulating more and more in white and pushing aside the black, eventually reversing the map where there's more white than black, and that's when we've got constitutional government restored in the white areas. And interestingly, if you look at this from a strategic and tactical standpoint, if I have a white dot that's 1 mile square, that's 4 miles of perimeter. If the government wants to contain that area, they have 4 miles of perimeter. They need a command and logistics center, but that's not difficult. But as another dot appears, they 4 more miles of perimeter and another command and logistical center. So suppose we've got 40 of these maps. They then have 160 miles of perimeter and 40 command and logistics centers. As those areas expand, when they get 10 miles square, they've got 40 miles for each of the white dots that they've got to contain. And their logistics and command center has to be larger than it was before. And as they stretch their resources on command centers and people competent to command, and they start stressing themselves on the logistical responsibilities by providing food, clothing, ammunition, other material, even toilet paper to these facilities, you can imagine that our demand on their resources is exponential almost to affect a change in the balance of power within or around the perimeter of any one of these white areas. As they cross state lines and begin absorbing the higher population areas, the map will become reversed. And at that point, we can begin looking at a revolutionary convention or a restoration convention where the leadership, the intellectual leadership of the patriot community can gather and begin establishing certain advisory boards to assist in a complete and total restoration of constitutional government. But you will see that it is based, to the extent possible, upon our local history and or our original history, and you will see that there is perhaps a solution other than revolution, which is open confrontational warfare, by using this expedient of the plan for restoration of constitutional government. The question. A few months ago, a friend raised a question in a conversation. The question was, could a revolution be conducted in the modern world considering modern technology, extensive government troops, and battlefield weapons? At first thought, the task seems so ominous, so daunting, and against such odds that it would be impractical, if not impossible. Upon reflecting on what must have been equally daunting to the Founding Fathers, it is not, as first anticipated, such an ominous task. The founding fathers faced British forces, the best trained and most successful military in the world. His navy was master of the seas. His land forces had recently defeated the French and had forced colonization around the world. It controlled the local governments and had enacted laws that gave it nearly arbitrary control over the colonies. The colonies had few things working for them. They had a lack of experience, except those who had recently fought alongside the British in the French and Indian Wars. Some had learned to defend themselves against hostile Indians, and thus learned fighting tactics used by the Indians. They had local knowledge of the topography, and they had the fortitude and persistence that had helped their forefathers and themselves overcome the obstacles of taming a land that had been little changed from its natural state. Against them were substantial numbers of highly trained soldiers, unlimited supplies and resources, although most of them were located across the ocean and had to be transported, this taking months, a multitude of locations, bases within and around the colonies, mastery of the waterways, and many of the military leaders had experience both with fighting Indians and working alongside the colonists. In those first few eventful days of April, May, and June 1775, the colonists learned that what their weaknesses were and what some of their strengths were. They learned that they were not trained, nor were they inclined to fight face-to-face on the battlefield. They learned that the tactics of Indians, ambushed by surprise, and hit-and-run tactics would damage both morale and manpower of the British. They learned that living to fight another day was more important than a victory in a single battle, that skirmishes were the best tactic unless a major battle had a high degree of probability of being won. One of the major drawbacks in their efforts was that of selecting officers who were astute enough to challenge the ways of traditional warfare. But they did, with their persistence and their faith in God, prevail. Not by might, rather by tactics and fortitude. Just how would they fight today? Surely they would adapt their tactics to the battlefield and would realize the political necessity of securing faith and assistance from the non-combatants. There are many other generalities that can be addressed, but of greater importance will be the actual circumstances of today's world and the necessity to develop new tactics in order to overcome obstacles that present themselves as the battle begins. That is the theoretical answer to the question.